Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, the host of the podcast. Each week, I'll be chatting to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time encouraging you as you listen to reflect on your own leadership journey. If you've not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so for free on iTunes or on Castbox. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and it would be great if you're able to take a moment to leave us a review. Russell Burney is back this week talking about his ministry in three of the four churches he has served. He goes from cutting his ministry teeth in Carrickfergus to pastoring a congregation in Newry at a time when people were feeling the weight of the troubles, and then to Ballymena, where he was minister of Highkirk for over 20 years. Along the way, we talk about some of the influences that have shaped his vision of church and how he went about bringing change to a congregation whose previous minister had been there for 36 years. Enjoy the podcast. Russell, welcome back. It's good to be able to continue our conversation. We talked in our first episode about early years in Fermanagh, coming to faith, and a lot of things that were involved around that. I want to talk a bit about your season of church ministry. I think overall, in various capacities, you served in four congregations. Would that be right?
That's right.
Sketch that in a little bit for us, and then we'll maybe dig into to each of them, different aspects of them.
Okay. When I was at New College, I was contacted by church authorities to say that I had been assigned to First Carrickfergus. It wasn't uneventful even at that stage, because I was already in correspondence with Ed Graham in North Carolina, cousin of Billy's, to be his assistant,
to be Ed Graham's assistant, or Billy Graham's assistant?
Ed Graham's assistant. But Ed Graham was very highly thought of. He was a Presbyterian, by the way, and he was highly thought of, and so we entered into communication to see if I was the kind of person he was looking for, and if he was the kind of, it was the kind of church that I wanted to go to. And it was very, very attractive, the whole, and as a young, recently married man, it was very tempted. I was very tempted to go to the States and follow through. But at that time, there was a postal strike, and the postal workers had been off for 3 weeks, and I had received no word from America. And I got a phone call from the Reverend Ronnie Craig, later Dr. Craig. And Mr. Craig outlined that I had been assigned to him in Carrickfergus, and they were looking forward to me coming and everything about it. And then I had to say, but Mr. Craig, I have other plans at the moment. And what? And he wasn't at all pleased. I outlined what was wrong. I said, but look, I'll tell you what. If I haven't received any answer by a certain day, I will take it that I'm to come straight home to you. Well, he agreed to that reluctantly.
It's another one of your fleeces.
One of the fleeces. Yeah. That's the, oh, I'm a very good man with fleeces.
Yeah.
and the day came, and no letter from America. And I just lifted the phone, and I phoned him, and I said, I'll be starting with you on the 1st of July. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And 2 days later, the letter arrived from America, agreeing that we would have this. And I had to get on my horse and write a note and say, I'm sorry, circumstances have changed. My loyalty is really to my own denomination here, so I have to go. And I did arrive in Carrickfergus, having sent a photograph of Arlene and myself to the church. So they put it in the magazine, and they were horrified at these two callow youths. I was the callow youth. Arlene was virtually the schoolgirl. We looked so young. But we arrived in Carrickfergus, young, long-haired, full of the joys of spring. And suddenly to realise that I was now in an important position, in the sense that I had was looked upon as the expert, particularly in youth work. And this was a congregation of over 800 families. It was the 350th anniversary of the founding of the church, one of the oldest Presbyterian churches in Ireland. And they had planned a youth mission. Well, I was no more an expert at youth work. I had never run a youth club in my life. And I had, on top of that, had this mission, youth mission.
So you were responsible for this grand occasion?
Not totally. They were having a congregational
mission. Part of it,
the youth mission, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, in a sense, I was to be the speaker. Mm-hmm. But there was a wonderful team already working. Mm-hmm. They set up this hall. It was brilliant. Mm-hmm. I went in fear and trembling, as I had never done anything like this. I'd never spoken in any real depth to a youth group. Mm-hmm. And I spoke at that. And you know something? It was a great blessing. Mm. There are people in ministry today, maybe they've retired by now, but who came to faith in Christ at that mission. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the lovely thing is, there was one convert at the main mission, and that one convert was my mother.
Ah.
Because she came up from Lisnaskee to Carrickfergus to stay with me, with myself and Arlene, in our flat. And I think it was with the specific purpose of becoming a Christian.
Oh.
And that was just wonderful as far as I was concerned. So that was a time of real blessing.
Yeah.
And it also launched me, by the way, into youth work, because I then had to set about a demoralised youth group to encourage them to delegate and to lead.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't have been a better experience.
But is there something then, you know, what were you learning about leadership there? Because obviously you're kind of pitched into the deep end.
Yes.
Without much preparation, very aware of your own, you know, lack of knowledge.
Yes.
And so on.
Yeah.
What sort of leadership lesson would you draw out of that?
Well, I don't know. See, there's a multitude of books on leadership today.
There are.
And also on spiritual leadership. Mm-hmm. I have to admit that I haven't read any of them at all. Because
not much point in me writing one then.
Well, no, but you've got the qualifications to write. I mean, my contribution would be very bitty, but it would be a contribution based on specifics that and experiences that have happened to me in my life. It was just being pitched into a situation and you had to make the best of it. And funny, you know, you derive a lot of principles and good principles and good ideas. And as I said, I learned how to delegate at that time. I remember the first meeting of the youth group that we had. It was in a hall and I wanted them to give me some ideas about a programme. And suddenly this missile was hurled from the outside of the group. It was actually a pencil, which, if it had hit me in the eye, would have been in there and would have done a lot of damage. Now, I didn't know too much about sanctification at the time, and I knew even less at the end, because it was a big guy at the end, and I went down to him and I told him in my most profound spiritual voice, if he ever did that again, it would be the end of him. And I didn't have any more trouble from him or the rest of the group.
Uh-huh.
And they became compliant. And that guy became, I think, either a lecturer or a professor of theology in some learned institution later on.
Right. But I'm sure he looks back on that moment.
It took a 6'1.5" 30-year-old assistant to tell him one of the truths of life that his daddy should have told him years before.
So after Carrick, then, you were there a couple of years, would that be right?
I was there 2 years.
And then,
wonderful experience in Carrick.
And then off to Newry.
And then off to Newry.
Let's locate this just in terms of what years this was. Thinking about the sort of the context.
1973 I went to Newry. 71 to 73 in Carrick.
Right, so 73 and you stayed in Newry for...
Nearly nine years.
So that's the 70s into the early 80s.
Yes.
So pitched into Newry, a town which knew a lot of issues around the Troubles.
Absolutely. I was introduced by Newry to Newry shortly after I arrived. There were three people who were murdered two of them blown up by their own bomb, mm-hmm. and a bystander in Monaghan Street. And that was my introduction to Newry, mm-hmm. A town where the people were of the community that I was ministering in were discouraged and downhearted, mm-hmm. and really were floundering, mm-hmm. in many respects.
Mm-hmm. How did that colour your ministry then? That must be massively different from being an assistant minister with responsibility for young people in Carrick, and yes. then moving down to...
Oh, absolutely. To Newry. And at a time when it was, in terms of ministers and churches, it was almost a buyer's market. You know, there were so many churches that were looking for ministers, mm-hmm. and so many approaches being made. Mm-hmm. And I had a number of approaches to very attractive settings, mm-hmm. but none of them registered with me until one day I was out doing some pastoral calls, and a wee lady came up to me who I hadn't a clue, but she knew who I was. Mm-hmm. She was called Mrs. McClure. Mrs. McClure said, "Now, Mr. Burney, you will be soon eligible for your own church. So I don't forget Downshire Road." And Downshire Road? Well, I knew there was Downshire Gardens in Carrickfergus, but I didn't know there was a church anywhere near them. And it turned out that she was talking about Downshire Road congregation in Newry. And I said, this is not by accident. So I began to probe it. And by that time, I contacted the convener and I said, "Look, I believe there's a vacancy. I would be interested." He said, "Well, sorry, the list is closed. The six names have been decided upon, but I'll bring it to the Kirk session." So he did. He brought this, mm-hmm. my name to the Kirk session, and they decided to add my name. And the rest, as far as I'm concerned, is history, mm-hmm. I was called. Mm-hmm. And I went down there, and it was so different. But I knew I was in the right place. Mm-hmm. One of the fleeces, Alan, mm-hmm. that I have is to... just to have a wee walk around the church, mm-hmm. go into it and go to the pulpit and strategic places. And I did that. Mm-hmm. And then I went up to the manse, and the manse, mm-hmm. was a semi-detached house, not like the mansions that are so often characterised, mm-hmm. other buildings. But it was the right place. Mm-hmm. And Arlene and I moved down there. Mm-hmm. She was at Stranmillers at the time, because when we came home from Edinburgh, she went back to college. Mm-hmm. And for the first year, she was in Halls. And I was down there, visited the whole congregation in a year, and got a lot of work done. So we started down there. But the leadership...
So I'm going to have to stop you there a second, because you just mentioned something that has the potential to be like a throwaway line, but I think, yes. I think it's worth pausing. You visited the whole congregation in a year.
Yes.
Okay, talk to us about that.
Well, I'm absolutely convinced that that is should be a requirement, mm-hmm. of young ministers, mm-hmm. In a congregation such as Downshire Road. 273 families, I think they had when I went.
So that's an average. That's visiting five families a week.
Oh yeah.
On average. Oh yeah.
Well, you're the maths expert. I couldn't work that out at the drop of a hat. I had the opportunity to do that. So, mm-hmm. the elders brought me round. Mm-hmm. I can't explain to you how troubled Newry was at that time, mm-hmm. and how downhearted and how much fright there was. Mm-hmm. And for even us to go out, mm-hmm. at night to visit families and carry on one's own ministry throughout, mm-hmm. the week, it was quite difficult. The reason that I say that is that my thoughts on the matter was I wanted to encounter these people as quickly as possible in case during the year I would have to encounter them in very sad situations, mm-hmm. and have to say I never met her, I never, mm-hmm. met him, mm-hmm. so we did that, short visits, not long visits, mm-hmm. at all, and got to know the whole congregation in a superficial type of way, and then whenever there were problems, as there were, mm-hmm. in that first year, I had been in the house. Mm-hmm. I had met the people concerned. I knew something of their lives, something of their background, mm-hmm. and something of their story, mm-hmm. and was able to piece together mm-hmm. At later stages.
Yeah, and did that, do you think that also made you made them think that you, how can I put this? They had a sense of your accessibility, that you were an approachable person. So when you stood up and preached on a Sunday.
Absolutely.
They knew this person who's preaching.
Well, I think so much of your preaching, so much of the application and the relevance mm-hmm. Must come from your interaction with your congregation mm-hmm. to know what they're faced mm-hmm. with, to know some of their good moments and less good moments. Mm-hmm. That is just an invaluable mm-hmm. Step, I think, in practical theology.
Well, what are the time management implications of that? You know, there are people, maybe young folk who are in early stages of church ministry. They've maybe got two sermons to prepare for a Sunday, and in some circles, another one for a midweek on a Wednesday night. They're maybe chairing. You know, a group of elders or other leadership yes, situations. Yes. The implications of also getting around the whole congregation in a year, how did you manage to arrange that?
Well, when I went to High Kirk, there were 610 families. Mm-hmm. The whole congregation was visited in a year. Hmm. And that included all the things that you're mentioning, but it also included explaining to the leaders what you wanted to do and asking them to help you in that process. Mm-hmm. So they helped in the practical way of driving up to the manse, opening the door of the car and bringing me and around their districts.
Right.
Each of the elders had a district, so mm-hmm. they knew them intimately. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones who were in charge of the timing. They would say, all right, Mr. Burney, I think it's time we went.
Yeah.
And so we were able to do... sometimes five a night,
right.
Alan, in High Kirk.
Yeah.
But in Uri, it was a different situation. There weren't as many activities. Yes, there were two sermons on a Sunday that had to be looked after. There were ways and means of doing that, of people sharing the load, bringing in folk mm-hmm. and they leading. And that wasn't a problem. Kirk session meetings only are held maybe once every 2-3 months in a smaller congregation. Mm-hmm. Logistically, it was quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
But down there, it was a totally different ministry. It was, in a sense, an unnatural ministry. Mm-hmm. I would listen to the news at 5 to 12 at night and 5 to 7 in the morning, the Northern Ireland news at that time. And often I would hear what was going on in my parish area mm-hmm. from that. There was so much trouble during my time down there.
Mm-hmm.
I buried 11 people and one later on who had been killed as a result of terrorism. So what was needed was just what in actual fact took place was a ministry of compassion and of encouragement. Just jizzying people along to try to bring them through a terribly dark period in their mm-hmm. life. And during my time in Uri, and we're moving on through the years, I was convener of congregations, different congregations. A group up in South Armagh, 2nd, Newton Hamilton and Craigan. Craigan was 1 mile from Cross Midland.
Mm-hmm.
Believe you me, it brought its own difficulties, lovely people, but they suffered a lot. And it was, when I said it was an unnatural, maybe that's not the right word, ministry, but it was. It was bringing people down to my congregation, bringing security people in to tell them how to look after their own security. It was horrific. And the more I think about it, the more horrific it gets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of preaching and pastoring people like that, and we even bordered, we came to things at funeral services emphasizing no retaliation, which needed to be proclaimed. And looking back now, you know, it was such a worthwhile ministry as well. And I was developing leadership skills that that I didn't think I had mm-hmm. with TV.
Because you would have been interviewed on television when incidents had affected
absolutely.
Your congregation.
And it was a case often that was just like sheep without a shepherd. Mm-hmm. Political people had no influence. Mm-hmm. They always appeared at funerals, but then they disappeared afterwards. I was meeting secretaries of state and government ministers. It was just so different than I had ever anticipated, mm-hmm. but very worthwhile at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And those years were very formative down there. It was a shock then to move on to Ballymena, and mm-hmm. where they hadn't suffered anything. They had mm-hmm. one bomb, I think, maybe in the centre of the town that mm-hmm. killed a person bad enough, mm-hmm. but... no appreciation of what had been happening.
But Ballymena then became your longest ministry in one place.
Yes, absolutely.
23 years?
Yes, 23 and a half years.
Okay.
Large congregation, evangelical, mm-hmm. but very traditional. Mm-hmm. I followed a ministry of 36 years and this was the most challenging of all the ministry situations. Newry presented its particular challenge, mm-hmm. but the other presented an even more difficult one. They called me to a beautiful complex, a building they had ported to and had just built a beautiful, beautiful building. They called me in order to bring about some change, because after 36 years they thought there was some change necessary, and it was.
So why would they have, what was it about you that they were identifying in you that you were potentially a change agent? Had you that reputation?
Possibly.
since this is audio only, people can't see the twinkle in your eye when you say that.
Well, I maybe had a high profile at that time. Mm. First of all, through the South Armagh and South mm-hmm. Down situation, and I would have maybe appeared on media and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But also, I was very involved in youth work. I was mm-hmm. convener of the youth board of the Presbyterian Church, and that allowed me opportunities to go into different places. And I remember going actually to and doing a youth mission in a neighbouring church in Ballymena. No, I think Highkirk were involved in it. And so they knew, they had met me. Mm-hmm. Some of them, the leaders, would have known me. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when they did approach me and I consented to be heard, They knew in a sense what they were getting,
right.
but they didn't, because change is a very painful thing.
Yes.
And during the interviews, it was stated, "Yes, we're ready for change," but while some of them may have been, others weren't.
Yeah.
And when change then was muted, it became difficult.
So,
having said that, let me just mm-hmm. say this: I spent the first year visiting. Mm-hmm. And them getting to know me. I didn't make any changes mm-hmm. or suggest any changes until after the first year was over, and then set up a series of get-togethers and meetings at which we outlined what our vision would mm-hmm. be. Nowadays, if you go to a church, you're presented with the vision that the congregation has.
Right.
And, you know, you are asked, can you meet with this? Mm-hmm. And then any changes you want to that vision has to take place when you arrive in the congregation. But I think one of the mistakes that is being made is this thing about getting to know your people. Mm-hmm. You can make... It's like a vet. If a vet has got a name as a good vet, but... He makes one blunder with a litter of pigs, and that litter is wiped out, then the reputation that he has built up will crumble very quickly. Mm-hmm. So you do, people have to get to know him as a person mm-hmm. and his qualities mm-hmm. before they will put their trust in him. And mm-hmm. it's the same with the minister. I think they have to get to know him, to get to know his heart, mm-hmm. What kind of a person he is. so that they can give them the benefit of doubt,
right.
of the doubt, right. if something right. happens in the ministry.
Right, and you were going to have to bring up, you're going to have to bring about change, and as you say, change is painful, it's uncomfortable.
Yes.
Sometimes people, you know, there's a joke, there's a little cartoon, and the first caption is "Who wants change?"
Yes.
And everybody's got their hand up. And the second caption is "Who wants to change?"
Yes.
And nobody's got their hand up.
Absolutely.
At that point, when they begin to realise the cost of change. What were some of the things that you, looking back on it, that you believe that you brought about, were areas that you brought about change in the church?
Well, my introduction to the congregation and installation was one night, and the congregational reception, once all the visitors had been dealt with and all the important people at that first installation, the congregational reception was the real one when I met them.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many lovely speeches made it on the first night. And what a wonderful person I was, mm-hmm. and what a wonderful ministry I was bound to have simply because I was that wonderful person. Really, I was disillusioned and a wee bit disturbed. So at the next night when I was speaking to the congregation, I said, look, a lot of things have been said about the minister.
Mm-hmm.
I hope in a very short time you will have stopped talking about the minister and you'll be talking about ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was one of the things, and I hope we can touch on that later on, Alan, I had in my resume and in my vision for the congregation that ministry was going to be quite different from that which I had practiced
mm-hmm.
for the previous 9 years and had been grown up to accept as the mm-hmm. only kind of ministry and believed that that was the kind of ministry that was being practiced in most Presbyterian churches.
So where the focus is on the minister and everybody else is just sitting around waiting for the minister to minister.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I know that in the years since, there have been a lovely
sure.
Lovely understanding of ministry as mm-hmm. The ministry of the body.
Yes.
Every member ministry
yeah.
rather than the minister.
Yeah. Now, where were you picking this up from? Where were you getting these ideas from?
Well, I picked
obviously yeah. the Bible.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But I need
one or two human influences who
yes,
are teaching you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I needed the interpretation of the Bible.
Yes.
I needed people to explain the Bible to me. I
yeah.
wasn't the finished product because at heart I was still the grocer from Listenski.
Yeah.
But in 1979, a friend of mine, Jim Waring, and myself and another couple from the in the surrounding districts went off to St. Michael's of the Belfry in York
mm-hmm.
To sit under the ministry of David Watson mm-hmm. in a week of renewal. And that was a fantastic week for me because it really changed my ministry. Yes, there was personal renewal, but there was also the opportunity for reflection on where I was going and what kind of ministry I would want to develop.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in Uri at this time. I had no idea that I was going to move. But David introduced this whole concept of every member ministry, that the minister, on many occasions, is the bottleneck
mm-hmm.
Of the bottle. Everybody's in there and their gifts are not being used. He talked about ministry and leadership and concepts I understood and knew about.
Mm.
But the added ingredient was one other word. It was shared.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if the church is to be the church, if it is to regain ground, if it was to move forward into the age in which mm-hmm. we lived, then there had to be emphasis on shared ministry where each of the people under God, using the gifts that he has given them, would be used to minister to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And not one man ministering to
mm-hmm.
618 families,
mm-hmm.
but all of those people, all of those believers within that group ministering to each other. And shared leadership, not all the gifts did not reside in one man. He's not just preacher. He's looked upon as preacher, teacher, healer, administrator, everything, and he runs himself into the ground. That is unbiblical, totally unbiblical. That ministry, that leadership responsibility is assured leadership. Mm-hmm. And he is one. Now, we knew that in theory, but it was never, ever practiced, nor was it stressed. Mm-hmm. And that was the start. David Watson also, shortly after our visit to York, published a book, I Believe in the Church. Mm-hmm. Now, next to the Bible, that has been the most influential book in my life. In fact, I have it out, sitting on the table, dipping into it because of the seminal truths that there are in that book. So that was the first thing, a definite change in my whole approach mm-hmm. to ministry and leadership. No longer was a one-man operation. I used to be quite annoyed when I would hear people from fringe groups talking about, and in a condemnatory way, the one-man ministry. I did not like that. The bristles, the back of my head.
We'll not identify the fringe groups.
Well, I'm not. But it's a delight now to know that within the traditional churches, that has been accepted. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the second thing was, in 1982, just prior to going to High Kirk, I had the opportunity of travelling over to Ottawa to a conference, the World Alliance for Reformed Churches Conference. And while it was good and grand, I was very glad that I had also booked ticket to go to Palo Alto in California and to visit Peninsula Bible Church, where Ray Steadman, mm-hmm. The author of a book which was having an influence in different circles called Body Life, mm-hmm. Was the pastor. Had a wonderful week there, working among that. I remember they had 14 pastors, by mm-hmm. the way. And I don't know what they did with themselves during the day, but I outlined the pastor for senior people asked me to outline my program. And I said, well, on a Sunday. And I said, well, I have the Bible class for young people before the morning service. I have the morning service. I have invariably got a service in one of the old people's homes in the afternoon. Then I have the evening service at 7, followed by the youth fellowship. And he looked at me and I thought, well, he'll be impressed by that. He said, Russ, he says, that's straight from the pit. But that was the kind of ministry it was. Mm-hmm. But looking in on their work, where they believed that their idea, that was the first introduction I really had to mentoring, and maybe under another, maybe discipleship. Mm-hmm. But their theory was, and it worked from the staff down. Each of the staff was meant to have 5 people whom they were pouring their life mm-hmm. into. In other words, they were mentoring. Mm-hmm. They would meet with them for breakfast, maybe at 7 in one of the men. You can meet people at 7 o'clock in a nice warm climate and have breakfast and then make arrangements and meet them in their home situations and have study with them and counsel, whatever. That was the first time I'd encountered that. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea was that God has, by his Spirit, has given us gifts. Mm-hmm. And these gifts are not to be, first and foremost, for the upbuilding of the individual, mm-hmm. but of the body mm-hmm. of Christ. Mm-hmm. Straight from Ephesians 4, mm-hmm. 11 to 13. And it is for the building up of the body, the church. And that was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, Ray came over later on and he mm-hmm. preached about in the church mm-hmm. in Ballymena. Mm-hmm. And we teased out a lot of these things. So this was the big thing for me that I was ultimately aiming to do in High Kirk, mm-hmm. and that was to teach on the gifts mm-hmm. of the Spirit. Heard an awful lot of about the fruits of the Spirit, and you can't hear enough about the fruits of the Spirit, but it was neglected, but mm-hmm. the gifts of the Spirit, mm-hmm. because of the controversial nature of, sure. of some of them.
Yeah.
But while the church in York was primarily a charismatic church. The one in California was not. It followed a Baptist Brethren background. But each of them was doing the same work as far as the church was concerned. I remember being called in, as we all were, at New College when I had done an essay on John Calvin. And I had no enthusiasm in doing that essay. And Professor Chain, a world-renowned figure in church history, he was talking to me about it. And I said, "Professor, I find it very hard to get excited about John Calvin. In fact, I find it very hard to get excited about some of the things that I'm being taught here." And he looked down at me over the glasses and he says, "Mr. Burney," he said, "one day you will get excited about some aspect of this study." And he said it sympathetically. He wasn't being sardonic or sarcastic or anything like that. And you know, he was absolutely right. Because the one thing I got excited about, and I'm excited about it still, is the doctrine of the church. I think it's the most wonderful concept. I think it's the hope of the world. I think it is brilliant. Sitting down with a blueprint today from working with a blank sheet of paper, we couldn't have worked it out. It has just been put in front of us. It is a most wonderful concept. And those two things came home to me with a real bang from those two places. I couldn't get home quick enough to try and transfer this. I had to translate it into my context. But boy, was that exciting!
Were you able to do that? Do you feel you were able to do that?
Absolutely, because I discovered that Alan Flavell in Low Memorial in Finihay had been there before me. I'd heard of these figures. He hadn't heard so much about David Watson, but he had Rhys Denman, and they had started to do this. Now, as I said earlier on, there were 610 or 615 families. Now, it is impossible for one man, even with an assistant as I had at the time, to make any meaningful contribution to their lives and to the church as a whole in terms of changing it. So after another year, no rush here, we took our time and we set up a steering committee to look at different aspects of church life. It's life and witness. There was an overseas mission and there was an evangelism. There was youth. There was administration. Various areas that we identified. We looked around and we didn't appoint conveners until we found the right people. Mm-hmm. We appointed conveners. This took place over maybe 2.5-3 years. And they had a group of people whom they felt were the right people there to make contribution, and they each brought back reports to the Kirk session with appended resolutions, just like the General Assembly, and which could be passed or refused or delayed. And gradually there was a transformation in the working and in the looking of things and the effectiveness of the church. And that's how we started. And then we, you know, as time went on, we became more, we started home groups. We ended up with, I think it was 12 or 15. That went up to 32. I'm not sure what it is now. But there was a whole transformation. But I don't want to go into that because a lot of other churches have caught up with us, caught up with High Kirk in that regard.
But there's something in being a pioneer, though, and doing things that other people are not doing.
But it's awful when they forget that you did, that you were involved in that, because, you know, there's a generation growing up that knoweth not Burney.
Well, they're still standing on your shoulders, Russell. They just don't realise it.
Oh, not at all.
What would it be? Was there resistance to change either in that area or in any other area that you tried to bring change in the church?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Can you talk about some of that?
Well, primarily in the area of worship. Now, that'll come as no surprise. But very early on, we made stumbling efforts and perhaps unwise efforts to change our worship from a congregation whose worship was dominated by organ and choir. Mm-hmm. And outside of that, nobody really had the opportunity, unless they came through the official grouping, to exercise their gifts. Mm-hmm. So that had to be changed, and it was changed, but very, very gradually. But lots of mistakes made. Mm-hmm. For example, we brought a young man from another congregation to help us with our praise, a musical group. And that was developed as a musical consort, but largely made up of wind instruments. So on a Sunday when they came, you couldn't hear anybody singing because of the noise of the trombones and the trumpets and the xylophones and whatnot. That caused a lot of trouble. I knew what I wanted, but it took a long time to get it. But it did gradually come. The one thing, now we come to leadership, the one thing that I am very proud of in Highkirk was that when the complaints came, as they streamed, as they came in torrents to the Kirk session, was that I never abandoned the musicians. I never took the side of the session. I never allowed them to condemn the work, because here were young people. They had been asked to do something. They were trying their best. Their efforts were questionable, but they were biddable and they were manageable. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful to see how, under the Spirit of God, that changed tremendously. And we came to a time of real quiet but effective worship. Now, music is only one part of worship. It became much freer. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, I don't know in your background, but corporate prayer was never a feature of services. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had communion services in which we just opened it up for people to pray at an evening
just
service.
Like the brethren.
Well, I've never been to a brethren assembly. Okay. Well, there you are.
So they can't take credit for that one.
Nor would I.
Yeah.
I would have given credit if I'd known that.
No. Of course. Listen, Russell. This is fascinating stuff. Time is racing, and rather than try to cram everything else that I still want to talk about into, you know, a few minutes and make for one very long broadcast, why don't we pause there?
Yes.
And we'll pick this up and we'll do part three. I still have a few things that I want to talk about. And if that's okay with you, it's fine by me, and I'm sure it'll be fine with the people who are listening as well. So, thank you.
As long as the same fee is available,
it's tripled.
For the third, that's fine. Okay.
Three times zero is still zero.
We'll stay on.
Thank you, Russell.
Thanks for listening to the Leadership Journey podcast, and thanks to Russell for taking the time to talk to us. He'll be back with us next week when he'll be talking some more about the issue of introducing change. And he'll be sharing some of the main things that he has learned about spiritual leadership. Be sure not to miss it. And in the meantime, have a good week.